Diane. Good to be with you. On my mind this week, I am reeling, as I suspect many of you are as well, from the horror that transpired last Friday at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Southern Florida. I spoke with NPR's justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson, about what, in retrospect, the FBI and local law enforcement could have done to prevent the killings, and about the emotional toll the threat of school shootings is taking on young people today.
Bulletproof backpacks for your child to take to school. Can you imagine? This is where we are now, and this is the environment that these students at Parkland have been railing against.
Then, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich stopped by for a conversation on what's wrong with America. He says our current president is not the cause, but the consequence of a long-term shift away from a shared commitment to the common good.
He is the result of years in which we just neglected it. We didn't even talk about it.
Now, here's Carrie Johnson, NPR justice correspondent. Carrie Johnson, how great to see you.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
I want to ask you about the FBI's role in general in shootings, this horrible shooting in Florida. Talk about a local FBI office and information that they may receive regarding individuals hoarding guns. What happens?
This is a complicated problem. I think it'll surprise a lot of people to learn that most law enforcement is local, that most crime is handled locally, and that the federal government needs to have some kind of special jurisdiction in order to get involved. That includes the FBI. The FBI doesn't investigate most murders. It investigates murders of people or attacks on people who are, say, members of Congress. It investigates when there's a hate crime alleged, when there's some kind of improper civil rights motive. As there was in the church shootings in Charleston, South Carolina. Or it investigates when there's a problem on federally protected land like a national park. But most school shootings don't fall into that category. So in most cases, the FBI is only responding after the fact to try to pour resources in and help. Now, with respect to tips, the FBI has a national tip line. It has phone numbers that people can call, and it also has an internet-capable tip line. And they get thousands and thousands of tips a day. What's supposed to happen is that when they get specific information that somebody is posing a threat, that that information is passed along to a local FBI office to talk with local officials, the school perhaps, parents, or whatnot. In this case, the new FBI director, Chris Wray, said that did not happen. This is a major failure by the FBI. What Chris Wray, the new FBI director, says is that on January 5th, they got information on the tip line, and it was specific and actionable information about Nicholas Cruz, the accused school shooter, that he had guns, that he was dangerous, that he was erratic, and that he even had threatened to shoot up the school. That information was not passed to the FBI field office in Miami, and none of that information got to local authorities before this attack, which killed 17 people.
How can that be? What is it that there were too many tips, that there were more dangerous things going on, or that they simply did not pay attention?
The FBI is investigating. They say it's clear that protocols were not followed here, but they have not given us a cause. There's an investigation within the FBI and the Justice Department. President Trump is very upset about this. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is very upset about this. Someone else is very upset about this. Republican members of Congress who've been demanding answers from the FBI. I would expect this to be the cause of a hearing or questions to the FBI director the next time he appears on Capitol Hill.
Carrie, here's the problem. A psychiatrist in Sacramento, Amy Barnhorst, wrote in the New York Times about the fact that there is no way to cure angry young men with violent fantasies. So even though, let's assume that this young man had been talked with by local FBI officers, what could have happened? They couldn't have taken him in for, say, 3-4 days. He could have gone out again. I mean, what happens in a case like that?
This is such a difficult problem. In addition to the failings we're discussing at the level of the FBI, it's also come out since this shooting that the Florida Department of Children and Family Services was investigating and making home visits to this boy's family after he began to cut himself on YouTube or some kind of social media site. And they concluded that he had problems, that he needed counseling, that his mom was trying to help with those efforts. Of course, his mom died last year, and he was living with a friend's family. They have since come out and said that they didn't know he was doing these postings. They knew he had weapons. They forced him to lock up those weapons in a gun safe, thought they had the only key. They were wrong. So his case is really complicated because so many people at different levels had warnings or were looking and couldn't put all the pieces together before this happened.
Carrie, do you have any idea how many local FBI agents there are in Broward County?
I don't know the number of how many people are in the Miami field office of the FBI. And the FBI also has, in big jurisdictions like that, sometimes smaller outposts as well. But remember, this is not the prime jurisdiction of the FBI. The FBI is also responsible for investigating terrorist threats, some of these homegrown extremists that may have traveled overseas to Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan and now be trying to come back to the U.S., or people who have been radicalized online. That's been a major focus of the FBI for the last 4 or 5 years. They're spending tons of resources on that sort of thing. And since predicting school shootings is not really in the FBI's wheelhouse, some people would argue it's unfair to criticize the Bureau for failing to pour more resources into that problem. But they are criticizing the Bureau for not passing along that tip on January 5th.
Now, is there a recording of that tip?
It has not come out whether that tip was taken over the phone or online. And the FBI director did tell us a lot of detail about what was in that tip. In other words, there was enough information. The person was described as being close to Nicholas Cruz, but they didn't tell us who exactly it was. They said that he was posting stuff on social media that was disturbing. He was behaving erratically. He had a desire to kill people. He owned a gun, and he had a potential to conduct a school shooting. Those are bells and whistles ringing, and that information was not shared with the FBI in Miami, let alone local authorities there.
So you're saying not even police in that area were informed of that tip?
Not of that tip, but we do know that Florida's Department of Children and Family Services had investigated this boy over the years. And the sheriff's office, I believe, has told us that they have gone to a house where that boy was living 20 times in the last few years. So he was certainly on the radar in some respect for a long, long time of local officials. It's just that nothing was done to prevent this before it happened.
But what could have been done? We go back to this question of, if you cannot, quote, cure these young men, what do you do once there has been a tip, once there has been concerns, complaints, worries that this could be a young killer?
I don't want to blame anyone or point the finger at anyone, but I will point out that in recent days, other potential school shootings have been prevented because family members of these potential shooters have come forward to authorities. That's happened in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area in the last few days. It's happened at other times where relatives of people they fear are violent and on the brink of doing something very dangerous have come forward. Police have use that as an opportunity to investigate, search the school locker of some of these students, search the homes of some of these students, find weapons, ammunition, and writings that would suggest something was about to happen. And in those cases, very dangerous situations, very violent situations had been prevented before they occurred.
So now we are hearing from young people, not only in Florida, but around the country, marches, even here in Washington, D.C., down to the area near the Capitol. Instead, they went to Union Station and staged a protest there. This is a very active and vocal group of young people. Do you believe that they can make a change?
It is certainly something remarkable to see these young people channeling their personal pain and tragedy into something bigger than themselves and what they experienced, and talking on behalf of students all over the country. I stopped making predictions after Newtown, Diane. After Newtown, after those little boys and girls were shot in school, six-year-old children, I thought that was a moment when Congress might have acted, when people around the country might have acted, and very little changed. And since then, we've had any number of mass shootings at schools and outside of schools. And policymakers and lawmakers appear to be in some kind of spiral where there are plenty of ideas thrown out. There's discussion about whether those specific proposals would have prevented a specific attack. And then everyone seems to throw up their hands. I was struck at the White House listening session of how one of these students at Parkland was sobbing because one of his close friends died, and he was comforted by a mother who lost her child in Newtown, Connecticut. And so these survivors are in some ways banding together and supporting each other. These young people do have a very powerful voice. They are not going away. I will point out they will become a powerful voting bloc soon, if they are not yet already. And that could make a difference, but I'm not willing to say it will for sure.
You know, even as you and I are speaking, Wayne LaPierre is speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And both he and the president have talked about schools as open targets and therefore the prospect of putting more guns into the hands of people within those schools. It seems to me that in moments of panic, unless you are an absolutely trained marksperson, things could go awry.
They can and do go badly wrong. I'm not a markswoman myself. I've done some trainings at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. But what people at the ATF and the FBI will tell you, if you get them quietly in a corner, is that when a crisis emerges or anxiety levels peak and those hormones in your body get going, unless you are a very, very skilled shooter and law enforcement person, there's a potential for great tragedy because you're not an accurate shot in those situations. If you have students in the hall, if you have chaos, and of course, how do you find the person who's the shooter? How do you find that active shooter? Are you sure you're right in a school with hallways crowded and people running around? There are some questions now about why it took so long at Parkland to find the young man accused of this crime and whether at different points law enforcement had handcuffed other students thinking they were the potential suspect. So imagine introducing more weapons into that scenario. That could be a problem. The president has since said on Twitter, President Trump, that he wanted to arm only a small number of trained teachers and coaches, people who had perhaps greater skill. These are very chaotic situations.
And now teachers are realizing that part of their job may be to protect and defend those students. This is something, I mean, I grew up in a safe school. And now to see these young people going to school every day, worrying about what's going to happen to them. Are they going to lose their lives that day?
The number of drills that these students undergo starting in elementary school or kindergarten or pre-K is stunning to me. When I was in school, we had tornado drills. We didn't have drills for shootings. And now there are actually products on the market that are marketed as bulletproof backpacks, Diane. Bulletproof backpacks for your child to take to school. Can you imagine? This is where we are now, and this is the environment that these students at Parkland have been railing against. Emma Gonzalez, David Hogg, and some of these other students who have banded together and are speaking at the state capitol in Florida and coming to Washington in March to march on Washington. They don't want to live this way anymore. They don't want to live under the specter of fear and danger, and they don't want anyone else to have to live that way either.
And the father of one of the students killed in Parkland talked to President Trump about the fact that he could only now visit his child in the cemetery. What was President Trump's reaction in that so-called listening moment?
President Trump actually sat and listened for a long time, which, according to his aides, is kind of challenging for him. He doesn't like to sit and listen for long periods of time. He listened. He expressed sympathy. He talked about the need for change, but he's been kind of all over the map about what that change would look like. He's talked about arming more teachers and coaches. This morning on Twitter, he's talking about potentially raising the age for purchasing assault-style weapons like this AR-15 that was used in Parkland and so many other school shootings and other mass shootings around the country. He ordered the Justice Department to ban bump stocks, which, of course, were part of the problem in the Las Vegas shooting.
But not in Florida.
Right. And there's a problem with that, which is the Justice Department has said twice, at least twice on the record, it does not have the authority on its own to ban those bump stocks.
Congress would have to get into it.
Congress has to act. So if the Justice Department begins this kind of process and tries to do something, it's going to be caught up in court for years and years and years. And that's clear. So there's a set of proposals on the table that are achievable administratively. There's a much more significant set of proposals that would require congressional action, and that's what we need to watch moving forward.
And Carrie, there is so much more to come on this discussion, but I'd like to turn the discussion now to Russian bots, what they are and what they're attempting to do. For those who do not or have not heard of these Russian bots or don't understand them, can you explain what they are?
Sure. These are electronic accounts. Sometimes they take over the social media accounts of real Americans or real Europeans or real folks all
over
the world.
Without people knowing it.
Without knowledge. And the social media services have been quite slow, at least until recently, in responding and closing these accounts. So they can send out targeted message about any old thing they want. And the revelation here, we've been talking about this really since the election in some ways, since the 2016 presidential election. Really smart former FBI officials like Clint Watts study this all the time and have been warning about it. But it really came home for a lot of people just last Friday when the special counsel unveiled criminal charges against 13 Russian individuals and 3 Russian businesses for really attacking the election infrastructure of the United States and the electoral process with information warfare by taking over accounts of Americans and tweeting out or posting on Facebook things that were intended to divide Americans, things that were hot-button social issues about Muslims, about Black Lives Matter, disparaging Hillary Clinton, promoting Donald Trump, promoting Bernie Sanders, using American partisanship at this moment in time to divide folks and possibly suppress the vote.
So as I understand it, they're posting opposing views so that they may post something favorable to Hillary Clinton and anti-Donald Trump, and at the same time posting something pro-Donald Trump and anti-Hillary Clinton. To what end, Carrie?
To make us fight with each other? to make people so disconnected and disengaged from the process that they don't want to turn up at the polling booth. This was more about promoting Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders than it was about promoting Hillary Clinton. To be fair, the criminal charges that came out last Friday indicate that after the election, these Russians had a pro-Donald Trump rally in New York City and an anti-Donald Trump rally in New York City the same day. And we were already fighting with each other. They exploited very successfully that sense of partisanship and disgust, I think, in some ways, with the division.
How do all of these revelations connect with Robert Mueller's investigation regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election?
This indictment, this 37-page indictment, I think has closed the question about whether any Russians interfered in the election. Everybody, even the president, now seems to acknowledge that happened. The question now is what needs to happen next to protect the midterms in 2018, the next presidential election in 2020. Meanwhile, Diane, this was only one small part of Robert Mueller's investigation. Perhaps the most meaningful part in some ways, but he's also investigating a number of other important things, whether anyone in the administration tried to obstruct justice or derail this investigation, whether Russian actors affiliated with the military or the government hacked the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, and released those emails in the course of the campaign, and a number of other financial crimes, including money laundering. The charge he's leveled most often so far, Robert Mueller, in less than a year of work, is conspiracy against the United States. He's not done with that investigation.
So what about the indictment this week of the young man and attorney living in London?
Earlier this week, another big surprise from the special counsel team. They announced a young man, a Dutch national, living and working in London as a lawyer for a major law firm, had agreed to plead guilty to lying to the FBI. This guy was interviewed last November by the FBI and the special counsel team, and he lied about communications he had with Rick Gates. Rick Gates is an American lobbyist. He worked on the Trump campaign alongside his mentor, Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chairman. Rick Gates and Paul Manafort are facing conspiracy and money laundering charges. This lawyer in London worked with both of them on a big lobbying effort to prop up the pro-Russian government in Ukraine at the time. And this lawyer lied to the special counsel team and the FBI about some of those efforts. He may have shared more. The special counsel is not giving us yet a full picture. But his guilty plea appears to do more to amp up the pressure on Rick Gates and Paul Manafort than to signal something wider at this time about the Russia investigation. There's one very tantalizing bit of information, though. This young man, this lawyer, is the son-in-law of a guy who's been labeled a Russian oligarch and a founder of Alpha Bank, which has been active in the news media accounts of Russian interference in the election and the production of that very salacious and unconfirmed Christopher Steele dossier. So this lawyer may have shared more about that, all of that, with the special counsel team. They're not telling us yet. They're keeping some information under wraps as they proceed with their investigation.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. Carrie Johnson, as always, great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we are back. Here's former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He's professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of a brand new book titled The Common Good. Robert Reich, it is so good to see you again after so many years.
It's great to see you, Diane.
Thank you.
Although the listeners can't tell, you look fabulous.
Thank you so much. You've written a new book titled The Common Good, and in it you say we've lost a sense of doing things for the common good. First of all, define the common good, and then tell us how you think we've lost our way.
Well, for the generations that went through the Depression, the Great Depression, and World War II, our interdependence was very obvious. In the 1950s and 60s, many people understood intuitively, they didn't have to have it spelled out, that our common good was a matter of public morality, what we owed each other as citizens, what we owed each other simply because we were the beneficiaries of two centuries of struggle to expand not only civil rights and political rights, equal justice, equal opportunity, but also the rule of law, that nobody was above the law. The idea that democratic institutions were critically important and you had to make sure that they worked. The notion that our economy had to work for everyone, that there was a notion of fundamental fairness, even though it's not as if we achieved these aspirations, but they were aspirations we shared. And if you talk to CEOs of big companies, or you talk to people who are at top levels in any administration or in the Senate or in the House or really anywhere, there was a kind of understanding that we were all in it together. When we talked about patriotism, Diane, we didn't talk about simply secure borders and saluting the flag and standing for the national anthem. It was something much more profound and much deeper. It was what we owed each other and, paying taxes in full rather than squirreling money away, making sure that we were a country that we could be proud of, investing in education and in infrastructure, and making sure there were not conflicts of interest.
At the same time, even looking way back in the history of our country, hasn't there always been those who worked for themselves, by themselves, not thinking about anyone else but themselves? Haven't we seen that all the way through history?
Oh, of course. There's always been greed. There's always been attempts by politicians to entrench themselves and their power. But what we've seen over the last four or five decades is something different. It's a widespread assumption that the institutions of America are no longer working. Distrust is deeper and bigger than it ever has been, certainly in my lifetime. And that distrust of every major institution, corporations, banks, government, you name it, has come out of a sense that the people who are in the leadership class of America are out for themselves. They're not really doing it for the public. They don't care. They've rigged the game. In fact, if there was one major theme in the 2016 election, both in the Republican and Democratic side, it was the game is rigged against you. We saw the emergence of authoritarian populism, personalized by Donald Trump. And we also saw on the Democratic side a kind of progressive populism in the form of Bernie Sanders. But both of them, in their own ways, very different ways, but both of them took on an establishment that seemed to be fundamentally not working for America, fundamentally corrupt.
It's so interesting because people have said Donald Trump somehow epitomizes exactly what you're talking about. That is the loss of a feeling of the common good. And yet you say in the book that Trump is the one who now stands at the forefront of this lack of common good but we have created it.
Very much so. I think he's the antithesis of the common good, but he's not the cause. He is very much the consequence. He is the result of years in which we just neglected it. We didn't even talk about it. I mean, I remember as a kid, I had in high school a course called Civic Education, and it was all about the responsibilities that went with citizenship. And that course itself went out. I mean, nobody talks about that anymore.
Did. Yeah.
But that's just one point. In the 1980s, greed was good. You remember in the 1970s and 80s, you had the takeover artists, the corporate raiders who turned corporations into much more of a money-centered, shareholder-centered organizations. You had, at the same time, Tony Coelho at the Democratic Congressional Committee drinking at the same trough as the Republicans in terms of big campaign contributions, money pouring into Washington simply to corrupt, and I think there's no other word for it, a political system that was already becoming disengaged from where the lives of most people were.
It's fascinating to me that we are so connected by virtue of the internet, by virtue of constant checking of our email. We're always in touch. And yet you say the irony is that we have lost connectiveness.
And I think that lost connectiveness is partly due, as has been said by many before, to social media that enables us to only talk and communicate with people who agree with us and gives us back the kind of positions we already came with, that is, reaffirms our prior positions. I think that we have, as part of our obligations as members of the society, to understand that we've got to talk to people who disagree with us. I tell my students all the time, the best way of learning anything is to talk to people who disagree with you, because that tests your positions. It tests your knowledge. It tests your understanding. If you don't talk to people who disagree with you, then you are condemning yourself to a little prison, an intellectual prison, an emotional prison. And that's happening all over the country. The truth is a common good. As the late Senator and Professor Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. And we've got to the point in terms of the erosion of the common good, we're not even agreeing on the fundamental realities.
You, in your first chapter of the book, talk about Martin Shkreli. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it.
Shkreli, yes.
All right. Talk about what happened there.
Well, Martin Shkreli, I use as a kind of embodiment of what's happening. Rather than Donald Trump, I could have used many other people too. But Martin Shkreli, as a young man, was very promising. He did well. But then Martin Shkreli took over a company and found a drug that was kind of an orphan drug and jacked up its price 5,000 times. This was a drug that was very important for people with HIV, people with certain rare diseases, and by increasing the price of this drug for no reason other than to make a huge bundle of money, Martin Shkreli was jeopardizing, endangering many, many people.
He was called before Congress.
He was called before Congress. He was considered to be something of a moral renegade. There was a lot of anger directed to him, but Congress didn't do anything. He was called in front of Congress, but you think that Congress did anything about the power of pharmaceutical companies or CEOs to suddenly increase the price 5,000% of drugs?
He said his obligation was to his shareholders.
Yes, and he was the primary shareholder, so his obligation was mainly to himself. Now, the subsequent life of Martin Shkreli is kind of an extreme form of that kind of selfishness, that narcissism, because he then was convicted of defrauding investors in other enterprises he went into. But it's not just a personality type, that notion that I can get away with anything, or and my goals are the only ones that are worth anything. But it is also a way of living that has multiplied. And there are more Martin Shkreli's there are around. And I don't want to sound partisan when I say the next sentence. The more Donald Trump personalities there are around, the more corrosion you have of the kind of public common good. Because everybody figures, well, if everybody else is out for themselves, if everybody is trying to make as much money or gain as much power, regardless of the cost, regardless of the consequences to our institutions, our norms, well, then I better get on the bus as well.
You say that Donald Trump has us talking about first principles. What are first principles?
He's got us talking about what we owe each other, what does citizenship really mean, beyond flag salutes and the kind of just adornments of citizenship. What is the common good? You see, and I think everybody understands what I'm about to say intuitively. You often don't appreciate something until you have lost it. You often don't know how important something is until it disappears or begins to disappear. And I think that what has happened with Donald Trump, and also in the years just immediately preceding Donald Trump, in terms of our country as a whole, look at the Wall Street meltdown of 2007-2008, people are beginning to understand that there used to be something called the common good. We have lost it. They didn't know we had lost it. Most of us have not really focused on it because we took it for granted. And now we can't take it for granted.
I want to talk to you about the president's tax bill. There are concerns among many that the tax breaks are going to the wealthiest in this country, and those at the lower end are going to end up paying more in one way or another. First, give me your overall assessment of his tax proposal.
Well, the tax proposal, which is now the law, is almost calculated to widen inequality, to hurt the lower middle class, working class, and the poor, and to increase the possibility of inflation. Now, why do I say that? Because almost every single study done on the effects of this tax bill, when it was still a bill, showed that the overwhelming beneficiaries over the next 12 to 14 years will be people who are in the top 1%, the richest 1%. The people who are in the middle, they may get some benefits initially. In fact, it was front-loaded so that they feel like they're doing pretty well. A lot of people say, well, I got $1,000, more than I thought I would. But actually, they will discover as the years unfold that what they thought was a benefit actually shrinks dramatically and then turns into a tax increase on the majority of Americans. So you have in this bill, which became the law starting January 1st, a redistribution of income from the poor, from the working class, from the lower middle class to the very wealthy. And Diane, at a time in our nation's history where you already have a gaping chasm of inequality, why in the world would you want to do this? The people who tried to sell the bill used trickle-down economic logic. They said, well, if you give big tax breaks to corporations and the rich, then they will want to invest more. But what we have seen again and again in this country is the trickle-down economics doesn't work. We've tried it at least twice, and it was a cruel hoax both times. Meanwhile, you're straining the federal budget, which means that the major programs that are safety nets, like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and many programs for the poor are going to have to be, well, at least Republicans are saying they're going to have to be jettisoned. They're going to have to be eroded. This is a double whammy if you are lower middle class or working class or poor.
Tell me how you believe the tax bill could affect those who in the past have made large charitable contributions.
Well, it takes away a lot of the incentive to make charitable contributions
because
many people are going to be using the standard deduction. It expands dramatically the standard deduction. And it also provides in and of itself such a reduction in the marginal tax rate of people who are very, very wealthy that they have no incentive to do a lot of charitable deductions
because
or any other kind of deductions.
Charitable deductions in the past could be used to reduce their overall tax.
That's right. In the past, they had an incentive to use charitable deductions to lower their taxable income. There's far less incentive now. But that's simply one aspect of the problems in this bill. I mean, the idea that corporations are going to use their extra profits that they now get to invest in their workers or
to
increase
salaries.
Wages is absurd. I mean, there's a little bit of increase in wages we've calculated, but most of the profits are going to what are called corporate buybacks, in which corporations simply buy back their shares of stock to artificially increase the share prices. That doesn't do anybody any good except the CEOs and major investors who enjoy bigger returns.
So from your perspective, this tax bill, which President Trump promised would help lower-income people, is doing nothing of the sort?
I think initially, I think this month, for a lot of people who have withholding, for example, that their taxes are withheld, those withholding tables have been adjusted. So again, it's front-loaded, so people think that they are getting more out of it than they are if they are middle class or lower middle class or working class. But it's much of it is a complete illusion. In fact, it'll show itself to be an illusion in just a couple of years, Diane. It's a hoax. I think this relates back to the theme of the book, because how can you get away with this kind of a hoax at a time when so many people have stagnant earnings or their earnings are declining, when they really do need an economy that's working for them rather than for people simply at the top, when corporations are already wealthier and richer than they have been at any time in our history. Corporations are putting so much money abroad just waiting for an amnesty, and they are getting in this bill something of a corporate amnesty for bringing their savings back. The corporations don't need any kind of amnesty. I mean, never in our history, post-World War II, have we had corporations with this much profit, not knowing really what to do with it. They are buying back their shares of stock, frankly, because they don't want to invest because there's not enough demand from consumers for the goods and services that they are creating.
What about the long-term effects on Social Security and their recipients?
But long-term effects, certainly Medicare and Medicaid will suffer because Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, have already talked about cutting Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid is already being cut in Kentucky and several other states that are requiring putting a work requirement on Medicaid. I've never heard of anybody not working because they cut Medicaid. I mean, that whole concept is sort of bizarre. The reason people don't work, some people don't work, because they are not healthy enough to work. What you want to do is make sure people get the medical care they need. So it's kind of upside-down logic. Social Security could very easily suffer. Because remember, the biggest items in the federal budget are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the military. If you are expanding the military and you're cutting taxes on the wealthy and on corporations, then the only logical place you have left to move is to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Bob Reich, you've never written a book that presents a problem without a solution. What are your ideas as to how we can actually revive the common good?
Well, the silver lining on this, let's call it a Trump cloud for now, is that many people are waking up to the fact that they have got to revive the common good. As I travel around the country, Diane, I haven't seen more citizen activism at the grassroots than I'm seeing now. People who have not been involved in politics or get out the vote drives, they are in almost every state I've been to, many red states, so-called red states, they are getting engaged and involved. Young people, my students around the country are now becoming more engaged in politics than at any time since
and
the anti-Vietnam War.
And we're seeing this in regard to guns after the Florida shooting.
Well, that's absolutely right. Look at the teenagers in Tallahassee, Florida. They are not alone. But also look at and listen to how articulate they are. And their commitment to making the country better, not just getting guns out of schools and creating some controls on assault weapons and so forth, but they are actually talking in much broader terms. In fact, if you look at the Me Too movement, hashtag Me Too, the hashtag Never Again, which a lot of these young gun control advocates are now using, and even Black Lives Matter, you see a welling up of something that is very new in America, and that is people who are saying, in effect, we are tired of and we will not tolerate abuses of power any longer.
But Bryce, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Really a positive thought that I hope is resonating across the country.
It is, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, I want to share my own thoughts on the shootings last week at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. I keep asking, as many of you do, when is enough enough? We've now witnessed yet another school shooting, this time a massacre in Florida, taking the lives of 17 people, students and faculty members. The killer carried a semi-automatic weapon, an AR-15. With deadly accuracy, he mercilessly aimed his gun at anyone within range and pulled the trigger without stopping. He did what he had allegedly been planning to do for months. He killed 17 people. In his mind, the gun he carried represented his strength, his power to carry out his deadly aim to kill people. Immediately came statements from politicians regarding mental illness. Mental illness, they say, is what caused the rampage. People with mental illness are deranged, they say. They do the unthinkable. It is they who should be blamed, not the guns they carry. But my question is, why are semi-automatic guns available for purchase to the public at all? If they're available, anyone can buy them. They're used by the military as weapons of war. But why are they placed in the hands of ordinary citizens? Hunters don't need them. They're not carried around as weapons of self-defense. In fact, they've now been used more than once to deliberately harm and kill human beings. But still, and again, we hear talk of mental illness with no mention of guns. After the latest tragedy, we heard the same old phrases and some new ones from so many politicians. Quote, Our hearts go out to the families who've lost loved ones. But now is not the time to talk about gun control. Indeed, the president flies down to his resort in Florida, visits the hospital where the wounded are being cared for, and compliments the doctors and the staff. He utters not one word on guns. Instead, tweeting disparaging remarks about the FBI and why he thinks they didn't catch the killer before he acted. Not a single word about guns or the assault rifle the killer used. Now, under pressure, the president talks about banning bump stocks, a ban the NRA opposes. Well, I think the young people of Florida's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School have seen enough devastation and have different ideas they are putting into action. Many of them are speaking out about guns, especially assault weapons, speaking out about the NRA and its hold on Congress, the money spent by the NRA to ensure members toe their line. And we know the fear the NRA engenders. Too many politicians believe that if they stand up with the young people who call for a ban on the sale of assault weapons, they might lose their seats in Congress. So we have to assume those politicians and their values lie more in maintaining a strong relationship with the NRA than maintaining the safety and lives of children and adults. The time may finally have come when that relationship must be challenged, when our elected officials must find a way to stand up to, instead of lying down with, the NRA. The young people will lead the way, and this time we can only hope they will, with persistence and courage, lead us to a total ban on the sale of semi-automatic weapons. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Leave us a voicemail. That number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Douglas Bell and Meg Bunting. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.